In the Sign of the Golden Wheel, Indian Memoirs of an English Buddhist, by Sangharakshita. Windhorse Publications, 1996. Read by Subhadra. Quote by Rabindranath Tagore, who lived 1861 to 1941. Life's memories are not life's histories, but the original work of an artist. Chapter 1. The Scent of Gardenias. One morning in early May, my devotions being over, I closed the summer house door behind me and made my way back to the hermitage by the path that ran between the ornamental trees. On passing the gardenia bush, I noticed among the glossy evergreen leaves two white double flowers. They were the first gardenias of the year. Having plucked them, I bore them indoors and placed them in a jar in the centre of my table, whence they diffused their rich scent through the room as I had my tea and toast, taught first a Nepalese and then a Tibetan student, and finally continued working on my new article called The Religion of Art. I was glad the gardenias had begun to appear. Vaishakha Purnima, the full moon day of the month of Vaishakha, corresponding to April-May in the Western calendar, was little more than 2 weeks away, and flowers would be needed for the decoration of the shrine. Vaishakha Purnima was the most important festival in the Buddhist year. It was the anniversary of the day on which the wandering, freelance ascetic Gautama had attained supreme perfect enlightenment and become the Buddha, or Enlightened One. According to late Sinhalese traditions, it was also the anniversary of his birth 35 years earlier, and his parinirvana, or final passing away, 45 years later. So that throughout Buddhist Southeast Asia, as well as in modern India, Vaishakha Purnima was known as the thrice sacred festival. It would be the fourth time I had celebrated it in Kalimpong since my arrival in the little Himalayan township in 1950, and the first time I had celebrated it at the Hermitage since the Young Men's Buddhist Association, in brackets India, had become the Kalimpong branch of the Mahabodhi Society, with me, the association's founder, as bhikshu in charge. And I wanted this year's celebrations to attract as many people as possible and to be an inspiration to Buddhist and Hindu alike. I therefore booked the town hall for a public meeting on the first Sunday after the Vaishakha Purnima, started preparing the hermitage for the specially religious observances of the thrice sacred day itself, and sent out hundreds of printed invitations and programmes. I also wrote to the subdivisional officer, asking him to give the pupils in government schools a holiday on Vaishakha Purnima, and to Monsignor and Mother Superior with a similar request in respect of Buddhist pupils attending the Catholic mission schools. Our full moon day meetings were usually held in the summer house, where the place of honour was occupied by the wooden image of the standing Buddha given me by Lama Govinda. But as the place was rather small, I decided that the biggest room in the hermitage should be turned into a temporary shrine. This room normally functioned as the games room, where our younger members played ping-pong, and since it had not seen paint for a good many years and looked decidedly shabby, I asked our Nepalese landlady to get it painted. She agreed, but did nothing, and in the end I bought a couple of tins of white paint and did the job myself. At least, I did most of it myself. Joe did the rest the following day, which was Vaishakha Purnima Eve, while Miss Rao stitched curtains and other members and friends decorated the place with greenery. I was not in favour of the usual paper flags, as well as decorating in a similar manner the bamboo arch that I had caused Man Bahadur to erect at the front gate, and for which I had made a welcome sign from red cloth and cotton wool. At this point, there was a catastrophe. After going home for lunch, Joe had returned to help me finish setting up the temporary shrine, which was already resplendent with electric blue hangings, rows of brass offering bowls, and borrowed silver butter lamps. Intending to do something to our alabaster Buddha image, he set it down on the edge of the ping-pong table, which was being used as a work table. Unable to bear the weight of the heavy image, the top of the table at once seesawed violently, precipitating the image onto the floor and breaking off its head. Everyone was horrified, especially our Tibetan and Nepalese members, for whom the breaking of a Buddha image was inauspicious in the extreme and bound to bring bad luck. And strange looks were cast at the wretched Upasaka, who stood petrified with confusion and chagrin. One who could be responsible for something as inauspicious as the breaking of a Buddha image must be highly inauspicious himself, the looks seemed to say. And it was obvious that the incident had served to confirm the impression, which I knew some of our members had formed, that there was something uncanny about the elderly Canadian Buddhist, who wore colourful American clothes that were several sizes too big for him, who waggled his bottom when he walked, and who accosted young men in a way they found acutely embarrassing. After the celebrations, Joe stuck the head of the Buddha image on with glue, but unfortunately he failed to get the upper and lower portions of the neck quite flush, and since the glue was of the super adhesive variety, the mistake could not be rectified. The alabaster image, given me 4 years ago by a devout couple in Burma, was therefore relegated to one side of the shrine, a position it retained when the latter was moved back to the summer house. Visitors rarely noticed the dark ring round its neck, but it was some years before those who had been present forgot how Joe had broken a Buddha image, and some years before the aura of inauspiciousness that came to surround the eccentric Canadian Upasaka was entirely dispelled. At the time of its occurrence, the catastrophe cast a damper on our preparations for the thrice-sacred festival, and it was not until the following day that spirits were fully recovered. After an early morning puja in the summer house, held for the benefit of our more regular members and friends, we gave the first wave of visitors tea and started putting the finishing touches to the decorations. In the case of the temporary shrine, this mainly consisted in arranging flowers in the various vases we had managed to collect, as well as in scattering them, Indian style, on and around the image table. Many more double white flowers having appeared among the glossy evergreen leaves of our gardenia bush, I had, besides other flowers, plenty of velvet-petaled, richly scented gardenias at my disposal. While I was trying to place them where they would show to the greatest advantage, a little girl brought me a bunch of gardenias from her mother. In the course of the morning, more bunches of gardenias arrived, as well as two or three small basketfuls of the same exotic flower, until I had far more of them than were needed for the vases and image table. Yet still the gardenias continued to come. The gardens of Kalimpong seemed to be raining gardenias upon us, the deluge culminating in the arrival of a perfectly enormous basketful sent down from Krishnalok by Princess Irene of Greece. Gardenias lay in fragrant white heaps on the floor. There must have been thousands of them. I therefore began sticking them into the greenery with which the temporary shrine had been covered, so that eventually the room was practically lined with gardenias. Those left over I stuck in the greenery surrounding the entrance, the windows and the veranda posts, stuck them indeed in every nook and cranny. By the time I had finished, the place was a veritable paradise of gardenias, and their rich scent filled the air. That night the former games room was packed, and the silver butter lamps cast a warm glow over eager, expectant faces and colourful national costumes, as well as over the solid walls of gardenias on either side. The meeting should have begun at 6 o'clock, but the governor of West Bengal, who happened to be staying in Kalimpong, and whom I had invited through the SDO, or subdivisional officer, did not turn up until more than an hour later. Dr. Mukherjee was a retired college professor whose appointment to the governorship had taken everybody by surprise, but who, with his simple, unassuming ways, had soon won for himself a place in people's affections. He was also a Christian, not a convert, but a member of an old Anglican family, and I was concerned lest he should not know that shoes had to be removed before entering the shrine, and dropped a hint to that effect. But I need not have worried. Dr. Mukherjee knew very well what to do, and in fact sat through the puja and through my own sermon on the significance of Vaishakha Purnima, as well as through the musical items that followed, with as great an appearance of devotion as any of the older Buddhists or Hindus present. After he had left, there was more music, and it was with the sound of the sitar and of youthful voices raised in praise of the Buddha that the meeting eventually came to an end. I originally intended to dismantle the temporary shrine the next day, but in such numbers did people continue to come in order to worship that I decided to leave it as it was for the time being. In any case, though Vaishakha Purnima itself was over, the year's celebrations were far from being concluded. The public meeting in the town hall was still to come, and organisations that were also celebrating Buddha Jayanti, as the thrice sacred festival was generally known in India, had invited me to address them. One of these was the Maitri Sangha, the Bengali cultural organisation, where I had already given a number of lectures, and where I had a small following of educated Bengalis sympathetic to Buddhism. On the present occasion, however, I was not the only speaker, there being three others on the platform with me, Badant Anand Kausayayan, the elderly Punjabi monk who took me on long walks whenever he was in Kalimpong, Swami Gangeshwarananda, the incumbent of the local Ramakrishna Mission Ashram, and Dr. George Rurich, the Tibetologist. I was more than a little surprised that Gangeshwarananda had been invited to speak, since he was very unpopular in Kalimpong on account of his evil temper and was known to be hostile to Buddhism. I could only assume that the organisers had invited him because he was the religious representative of the Bengali Hindu community, so to speak, and because they were confident he would observe the proprieties. But if such was their confidence, it proved to have been misplaced. When it was his turn to speak, the Swami launched into a virulent attack on Buddhism, an attack which ended with his exclaiming, in tones of the utmost contempt, "But what sort of religion can you expect from someone who died from overindulgence in pork?" The little audience was deeply shocked. I said nothing at the time, but after the meeting I protested to the secretary of the Sangha, as did several other people. I also called on the president of the Sangha on my way back to the hermitage, and protested to him too. Genial Dr. Borral was quick to promise that such an incident would not occur again. A few days later I heard that Mrs. Charumitta, the influential Bengali lady, whom some called the Queen of Kalimpong, was extremely displeased with the Swami's behaviour, and that, like Dr. Borral, she intended there should be no repetition of the incident. Whether prompted by Gangeshwarananda's attack on Buddhism, or for some other reason, the morning after the Maitri Sangha meeting, I started writing a satirical sketch on Brahmanism entitled "How Buddhism Disappeared from India." Badant Anand, to whom I read the extracts, thoroughly enjoyed this little jeu d'esprit, but though I finished it a couple of weeks later, the work was far too scathing to be publishable in India, and I never gave it a final revision. The lectures at the Maitri Sangha were all in English, but at our public meeting in the town hall, which in fact preceded the Maitri Sangha meeting by a week, The lectures were in 4 or 5 languages. The reason for the diversity was that the population of Kalimpong was a polyglot one, and I wanted everybody to be able to hear the Dharma in his mother tongue, or at least in a language with which he was familiar. This policy, or rather principle, of mine was well known in the town, and our Vaishakha Purnima public meeting was therefore attended by people from all sections of the community, whether Buddhists or Hindus, hill people or plainsmen. Though the lectures were in so many languages, there was no disharmony between them in point of content, much less still any disharmony between one speaker and another. And when after the 3-hour programme my helpers and I took down the decorations, we could congratulate ourselves on a truly successful meeting. The day before there had, however, been a little disharmony between one of the speakers and Joe. The speaker in question was Miss Barclay, an elderly Englishwoman of generous disposition but uncertain temper, who had arrived in Kalimpong earlier in the year and was now one of the hermitage's most frequent visitors. The scene of the disharmony was my room. Joe had come in to discuss the next day's public meeting with me, and Miss Barclay was furious with him for taking up my time, as she saw it, when she wanted to talk with me herself. Her outburst astonished the poor Canadian Upasika, who was accustomed to being at the originating rather than at the receiving end of such displays of temperament, and I had to intervene to restore the peace between these two Western followers of the Dharma. Miss Barclay had recently become a Buddhist, much to the annoyance of the local missionaries. Later I explained to Joe that it was by no means unusual for Miss Barclay to fly into a tantrum, and that he should not take it too seriously. The good people of Kalimpong had hardly finished celebrating Buddha Jayanti when there came news of an event that for many days intermitted all other topics of conversation. Everest was conquered. Edmund Hillary and Tenzing Norgay had succeeded in reaching the top of the highest mountain in the world, where hitherto no human foot had trod. The Nepalese in particular were wildly excited, for Tenzing Norgay was a Sherpa, and inasmuch as the Sherpas were Nepalese by nationality, even if not by ethnic origin, they were in fact of Tibetan stock, his achievement could be regarded as demonstrating, in the eyes of the whole world, the superiority of the Nepalese people in at least one field. They might not have produced an internationally renowned writer or scientist, or even an internationally renowned politician, but they had produced Tenzing Norgay, the conqueror of Everest. So proud were the Nepalese of their hero, and to such an extent did they identify with him, that they were impatient of any reminder that Tenzing Norgay was technically an Indian citizen, and that he had not stood on the summit of Everest alone. Among younger Nepalese, the name of Edmund Hillary was hardly ever mentioned, while that of Sir John Hunt, the leader of the expedition, was not mentioned at all. Listening to them, one could easily have thought that Sherpa Tenzing, as he was generally called, had reached the top of Mount Everest by his own unaided efforts. I myself felt little or no excitement when, on the morning of Tuesday the 2nd of June, Miss Barclay brought the news that Everest had been conquered. Though I could appreciate the courage and determination that had made such an achievement possible, the idea that a mountain, or any other part of nature, was something to be conquered, was foreign to my whole way of thinking and feeling. Mountains were alive. Indeed, there were mountains, Everest itself being one, which could be said to have personality, in the sense of having the power to attract people and influence them. A mountain of this kind was a sacred mountain, and the proper attitude towards it was one of reverence and worship. In the words of a modern pilgrim to Mount Kailash, the most sacred of all the mountains in the Himalayan system, this worshipful or religious attitude is not impressed by scientific facts like figures of altitude, which are foremost in the mind of modern man. nor is it motivated by the urge to conquer the mountain. Instead of conquering it, the religious-minded man prefers to be conquered by the mountain. He opens his soul to its spirit and allows it to take possession of him, because only he who is inspired or possessed by the divine spirit can partake of its nature. While the modern man is driven by ambition and the glorification of his own ego to climb an outstanding mountain and to be the first on top of it, the devotee is more interested in his spiritual uplift than in the physical feat of climbing. To him, the mountain is a divine symbol, and as little as he would put his foot upon a sacred image, so little would he dare to put his foot on the summit of a sacred mountain. End of quote. Lama Govinda's sentiments were very much my own, and I was therefore unable to share the jubilation of our Nepalese members and friends that Everest had been conquered, and that a man of their own blood had been the first to stand on the untrodden snows of its summit. But Tuesday the 2nd of June, the day on which I received the news of the conquest of Everest, was also Coronation Day. Later it was rumoured that the news of Hilary and Tenzing's achievement had been deliberately held back in order that its release on that day might be a present, as it were, to the new monarch, Elizabeth II, on the occasion of her coronation. Be that as it may, I was as little excited by the coronation as I was by the news of the conquest of Everest. 9 years had passed since my departure from England, and I had no thought of returning. Moreover, I was a monk, and since that be-rainbowed August morning 6 years ago, when I had gone forth from home into the life of homelessness, it had been my conviction that one who had renounced the world had no exclusive mundane loyalties, whether national or racial. Though known in Kalimpong as the English monk, I did not really think of myself as such. Language and literature apart, my links with the country of my birth were tenuous, being more or less limited to the occasional exchange of letters with English Buddhists. It was therefore hardly surprising that I should not have been excited by the coronation, or that I should have given it no more thought than did my Nepalese and Tibetan friends. The only people who were at all excited by it were the handful of elderly British residents who had stayed on after independence, and of course the occupants of that stronghold of Scottish Presbyterianism, Dr. Graham's homes, where 500-odd children of mixed parentage were brought up as Christians and taught to think of the United Kingdom as home, and where, not surprisingly, the film of the coronation was soon being shown. I did not see the film. Not only was I not interested in seeing it, but monks were not supposed to see films, and in any case, I knew that I was persona non grata at the homes. Miss Barclay saw it, however, and afterwards gave me an account of the feudal pomp and ecclesiastical circumstance by which the coronation ceremony had been surrounded. She also lent me her copy of the Daily Mirror coronation number. Of only one picture of the coronation do I retain even a faint recollection, a picture of the Queen, newly crowned and sceptred, sitting in the coronation chair, and looking strangely young for so great a responsibility. More vivid is my recollection of another picture, which I may actually have seen not in the Daily Mirror coronation number, but in an earlier issue of the same popular newspaper. This was a picture of three women in deep mourning, standing together, heavily veiled, in attitudes expressive of sorrow, shock, and resignation. Below was the caption, "Three Queens, One Grief." The occasion was the funeral of King George VI, and the three queens were Queen Mary, Queen Elizabeth the Queen Mother, and Queen Elizabeth II, one of whom had just lost a son, one a husband, and one a father. There was a quality of timeless, archetypal tragedy about this triple image that I found deeply moving. It was as though the three fates, or three norns, were mourning doomed humanity. I'd seen Queen Mary during the war walking over Westminster Bridge accompanied by a single lady-in-waiting. Then, too, she was in mourning, the Duke of Kent, her youngest son, having been killed recently in a flying accident. Years earlier, I had seen the future Queen Elizabeth II, then Princess Elizabeth, riding with my father on the top of a red double-decker London bus when I was 6 or 7 years old. I'd found myself looking down over the wall of a West End mansion. In the garden, two little girls were playing, one slightly bigger than the other. "Look," said my father as the bus moved on, "there are the two little princesses, Elizabeth and Margaret Rose." But these were only memories. Not long after Vaishakha, I had a visitor who came straight from the Britain of the second Elizabethan age, as it was hoped the new reign would prove to be, and who provided me with a more direct and tangible link with my native land. The visitor was a very small, very upright, very severe-looking woman in traditional Tibetan dress, complete with rainbow apron. She was Dawa's mother. Dawa Tsering Bhutia was one of our oldest and most faithful members. Though in government service, he was secretary of our little branch of the Mahabodhi Society, as he had been of its predecessor, the Young Men's Buddhist Association, brackets India, in his student days. Reliable and conscientious to a fault, he was at the same time inclined to be anxious, and it was with considerable trepidation that he had brought his formidable little mother to see me. Had her Dawa been behaving himself while she was away, she wanted to know, or had he been wasting his time hanging round the bazaar and getting into bad company? She hoped he had not been drinking or smoking or chewing tobacco, since otherwise she would have to give him a good thrashing. Fortunately, I was able to reassure her on all these points, and her rigid features relaxed a little. What I would have said, had she also hoped that her son was keeping clear of women, I do not know. My young friend was desperately in love with a Nepalese girl whom he wanted to marry, and was terrified lest his mother should find out, since she had often declared that under no circumstances would she allow him to marry anyone but a Tibetan. During his mother's visit, Dawa was very much on tenterhooks, in case I should inadvertently let slip something about him that he did not want her to know. But luckily this did not happen, and mother and son were able to leave the hermitage apparently reassured in her case and relieved in his. The straight-laced, strong-minded little Tibetan woman made quite an impression on me. Our conversation was carried out mainly in English, a smattering of which she had picked up from the family for whom she worked as an ayah in England, and to whose services she would soon be returning. But although her very limited English was decidedly of the fractured variety, with occasional lapses into Nepali, she spoke it not only with the utmost aplomb, but with an upper-class accent and intonation that would have done credit to a duchess. Listening to her, I could at times have fancied that I was in a drawing-room in the home counties, rather than amid the foothills of the eastern Himalayas. The link with my native land with which she provided me, at least for half an hour, was a direct and tangible one indeed. Not that Dawa's mother was my only visitor during this period, that is, my only visitor from outside Kalimpong. Visitors from the town itself came every day and at all hours. There were visitors from Poland and America, France and Germany. The French visitor was Miss Delannoy, the short, untidy Sorbonne alumna who had spent a couple of weeks in Kalimpong earlier in the year, and who even then had seemed to be more interested in Buddhism than in the subjects she was supposed to be studying. Having made a trip to Nepal, she was, in fact, now staying in Gum, and shortly after her arrival in Kalimpong, took the 3 refuges and 5 precepts from me. She was, I noticed, more balanced than she had been at the time of her previous visit. The German visitors were Dr. and Mrs. Liebenthal. Frail and evidently poor, the gentle old couple had not come direct from Germany, which they had left in the 30s. They had come from China via Shantiniketan, at whose China Bhavan Dr. Liebenthal was now teaching. A sinologist of international repute, he had translated the Chinese version of the Sutra of the Lord of Healing into English, and on his second visit to the Hermitage, he presented me with a copy of this work, by which he clearly set great store. My most interesting visitor, however, was not from Poland or America, France or Germany. He was from Japan. Dr. Kajiyama arrived at the Hermitage 2 days after Vaishakha Purnima, when the temporary shrine was as yet undismantled, and the scent of gardenias still filled the air. He arrived at the end of our evening puja, and after showing him his room, he was an expected guest rather than a casual visitor, I accompanied Miss Barclay and Miss Delanoy to the bazaar, both those ladies having attended the puja. While I was out, the young Japanese scholar must have sat and meditated in the deserted shrine room between the walls of gardenias, for he afterwards told me that even in the Zen monasteries of his native Japan, he had not experienced so peaceful an atmosphere. During the month he stayed with me, he gave not the slightest trouble. He was an ideal guest. Slim and self-effacing, he flitted about like a shadow, being particularly careful not to disturb or interrupt me when I was busy. One afternoon I took him and Anandji, as Badant Anand was generally called, to see Dr. Rurich, and the veteran Tibetologist was glad to have news of the Pali Institute at Nalanda, where Dr. Kajiyama was studying and teaching, and whence he had travelled up to Kalimpong to escape the burning heat of the plains. The institute had been started 2 years earlier by my teacher, Bhikkhu Jagdish Kashyap, and though the ever-sceptical Anandji had doubted of its success, it was now doing well and had attracted some distinguished scholars. Halfway through his stay, Dr. Kajiyama spent a few days in Darjeeling, which was 8,000 feet above sea level to Kalimpong's 4,000. It was as though Kalimpong was not cool enough for him, and probably the misty, pine-clad slopes of the Queen of the Hill Stations was more reminiscent of Japan than were the maize-planted terraces of her more tropical younger sister. However that might have been, Dr. Kajiyama must have thought of his native land quite a lot, for we talked about Japan and discussed Japanese Buddhism on more than one occasion. In particular, we discussed Ashvaghosha's Awakening of Faith in the Mahayana.
I'd come across this seminal work in Suzuki's translation during my wandering days in South India. I'd found it in the library of a Hindu ashram where I was staying, and so great an impression did it make on me that I at once copied the entire text into my notebook. That notebook I still had with me, and I still reflected from time to time on the teachings of the profound and cryptic little work, which, according to some modern scholars, was an original Chinese composition, but which had in any case exerted a strong influence on practically all the major schools of Far Eastern Buddhism. I was particularly struck by the concept, or rather image, of perfuming, distant reflections of which even found their way into my poetry. In early Buddhism, samsara and nirvana were mutually exclusive realities, which left unresolved the question of how they were related. According to Ashvaghosha, or whoever wrote under that name, the relation between them is one of mutual perfuming. Clothes have no scent in themselves, but if they are permeated with perfumes, then they come to have a scent. Similarly, the pure state of suchness, Ashvaghosha's term for the absolute, is without defilement, but upon its being perfumed by ignorance, there appear upon it the marks of defilement. In a corresponding manner, the defiled state of ignorance is devoid of any purifying influence, but upon its being perfumed by suchness, it comes to have such an influence. Indispensable though the help of Buddhas, Bodhisattvas, and spiritual friends may also be, A man is able to renounce samsara and realize nirvana primarily because his deluded mind is permeated by the perfume of suchness, a perfume far surpassing the scent of gardenias.
End of chapter 1.